You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now it's time for our monthly check-in on the world of science. Ghostly particles known as neutrinos are helping researchers learn more about the universe around us. We'll take a look ahead at what 2019 holds for the world of mathematics, and we'll check out some clocks that are so precise they might help us measure the effects of gravity. Bill Andrews is Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Bill, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much. It's good to be back.
Well, Bill, I know you're a space guy in a lot of ways, so let's start with our space story, neutrinos. You focused a lot on that lately. There's a lot of cool research going on, some of it in association with UW-Madison, I know. First, let's start off with the basics, because these things are weird. What are neutrinos?
Yeah, the typical line that everyone likes to use is that they're ghostly particles because they're so strange. They don't really interact with other things, like electrons or protons or the normal kind of particles you're used to hearing about can touch each other, can feel each other through the electromagnetic force, or they can feel gravity, or, you know, they can you can feel them. You can tell they're there. But neutrinos zip right through almost everything. It's like they don't touch it. That's why they call them ghostly. So these particles were just theoretical for a long time. They have no charge, little neutral ones is what the name actually means from Italian, I think. The guy who just invented them, the neutrino, called them something nice, little neutrals. And over the years, we've gotten more precise and realized they exist, realized they come in kind of various flavors and more about them. And, yeah, and then this past summer, a kind of a big deal discovered one. They found one had interacted in the South Pole in the ice cube detector in Antarctica.
Right, and we've talked about the ice cube on the show before. Basically, they're using Antarctic ice as a huge neutrino catcher, right?
Yeah, because most neutrinos will pass right through it every second. You and me and everything else, we're getting just inundated with neutrinos all the time. And we don't feel it because they don't interact with anything. But this detector at the South Pole has so much ice in it. They've rigged electrodes throughout it so they could tell the one occasional stray neutrino that does interact with it, and a very, you know, any individual one would be very unlikely, but you get a big enough area, you could spot the one that might interact. So that's how they were able to find this telltale signal that one had come through.
So it's like a football going past the uprights. They never hit the uprights themselves, but when they do, you can finally detect it.
That's right. Only
unless you're playing in Chicago.
About 20 miles across or something. Well, yeah, exactly.
Now, they're little, they're hard to detect, but it turns out they might tell us a lot about the rest of our universe. What kind of things can we learn from these neutrinos if we can spot them?
Well, what's cool about neutrinos, and specifically this one that they found at Ice Cube, is that the same processes that create neutrinos create other interesting particles that behave more normally, so they get blocked by dust or by long distances. They can kind of peter out. So it isn't even always the neutrino itself that's interesting. It's that they are kind of a symptom of the disease that can cause them. Only astronomers would not like me to say disease. The beautiful flurry of activity that can produce neutrinos and other particles. And what was exciting particularly about this one that they found was that it's the first time that scientists have found a high-energy neutrino coming from a specific source, a really busy, angry-looking black hole that they call a blazar. And that's exactly where the neutrino was coming from. They traced its path, and it points to the black hole. And they found other related particles in the atmosphere and other detectors around the world about the same time. So they know that these events are linked, and so now that we realize we really can use neutrinos to spot things in the outer universe, this black hole in this case, it kind of opens up a new opportunity for how astronomers can probe the universe on its own.
Yeah, what does it take to create these neutrinos and shoot them across, lots and lots of light years to where they show up on our planet?
Billions and billions, as somebody, someone or other
yeah,
might have
who was
said.
That?
Some Carl, somebody maybe. That's a very good question because scientists aren't 100% sure what kind of process produces it. They just know that this black hole caused these things to come out, and they have an idea about when there's enough stuff swirling around a black hole trying to get in, because we all think of the black holes as these vacuum cleaners, these giant mouths in space sucking in whatever can come nearby. But if there's enough stuff nearby, it can cause kind of a traffic jam, and all the material, all that matter will bump against each other and get really hot from the friction. That can emit energy and can emit all these kinds of things. So that process maybe possibly is probably what's causing these neutrinos and other particles to come out. But like I said, scientists aren't 100% sure. So that's one more reason to study them and be able to look at neutrinos in depth, because then that'll tell us about this black hole and what specifically it's doing that can result in a neutrino, or almost certainly many, many, many neutrinos coming out that allowed us to pick out just one.
Before we leave space, you also did a little write-up on probes and what's going on here at home in our solar system, from the sun to Pluto. One or two things that you're really excited about, maybe that we're about to learn about.
Oh, sure. Well, just a week or two ago, we had the InSight lander on Mars actually made it, actually touched down, and we're starting to hear some of the first observations from it. And here, literally, there's just today, I think, a story about the some of the winds and some of the other amazing detections that they've made from the surface of Mars in a totally new way. That's very exciting. You mentioned the sun. The Solar Parker probe is getting closer and closer to the sun. It's just a probe, another satellite, but it's orbiting the sun and getting a little closer every time it goes around. And eventually, in a couple of years, it's actually going to be so close that it's within the corona, so within the sun's atmosphere, closer than anything we've been able to send to the sun before. So we'll be able to learn that much more about our local star, which a lot of people are surprised to think, don't we already know everything about it? It's right there. It's the sun. But no, there's still tons of mysteries that we're just on the verge of being able to figure out.
We're talking about some of the latest news in the world of science with Bill Andrews from Discover Magazine. Let's turn to clocks now, Bill. These atomic clocks, very precise. First of all, talk about atomic clocks and how they work and why they're so precise.
Yeah, atomic clocks are kind of one of those ideas, anything quantum-related, I sort of have a grasp on, but I can't get too detailed because then everyone will get lost in the details.
It's crazy. Me too, yeah.
And, so atomic clocks work kind of the same way as anything else. Any clock works on the repetition of something, right? A pendulum going back and forth, or the sun's shadow on a sundial moving. You can see the pattern, and that's what gives you the ticks and the tocks of seconds or whatever you're measuring. And atomic clocks work the same way, only those ticks and tocks are actual atoms and the different energy states that atoms could be in. Again, this is some of that quantum stuff. So using lasers to hold atoms in place, scientists can create really accurate clocks that don't lose time in billions of years. They'll still be accurate, and they're reproducible, and they're very, very accurate clocks, which is important not just for timekeeping, but all kinds of related issues.
And here's where it gets really mind-blowing. There's a thought that the newest, most accurate clocks could help us measure the relativity effects of gravity. So like when you're in a gravitational field of, say, a planet or a sun, it actually makes time flow a little differently?
Yeah, it's very mind-bending. It's very kind of, you got to eat the right brownies to get it. But that's, you got it in one, though. That's part of Einstein's relativity theory, that because space and time are interwoven in space-time, and relativity, different things depend on your speed and where you are. Yeah, clocks actually tick faster if you're on top of a mountain than at ground level. Or if you're moving really fast, your clock will tick slower than the ones outside of your speeding ship. So that's how accurate these new atomic clocks are. Normally, those effects, those slowing clocks, they only slow a tiny little bit. But now we're so accurate with our atomic timekeeping pieces that we're actually able to, theoretically, they haven't done this yet, but the clocks are that accurate, they should be able to detect the different effects that gravity is having on the flow of time itself.
Wow. I mean, that's kind of hard to fathom. And this is not something we could do with a stopwatch. That's nowhere near precise
enough.
No,
unfortunately.
This is like a really, at the speeds we're talking about, at the gravity we're talking about on Earth, this is a really subtle effect, right?
Yeah, it's on the order of a billionth of a billionth. Again, that's another Carl Sagan for you.
Ten
to the minus 18. So that's how low the error bars are on these clocks. And then that's about where you start seeing these effects of a continent that's 100 feet higher up than another continent that's 100 feet lower down. it'll be tough to measure ground level on the two of them otherwise, you know, because for the whole continent it's a lot lower. But now, because it's that much of a difference in height, and time depends on how high up you are, how much farther from Earth's gravitational well you are, these clocks will be able to tell you.
And I'd left just a minute or so, Bill, to talk about developments in the frontiers of mathematics. You profile a mathematician, an award-winning mathematician. When you think about mathematical breakthroughs, I mean, these aren't people sitting in a lab with beakers filled with numbers. How are mathematicians finding new ways to expand the frontiers of how we understand numbers and geometry?
Yeah, it's a very tricky thing, and we even asked this guy directly, is this going to be useful outside of math? And he's up front, and he says it is very abstract. It's still very math-related, so there aren't other useful things yet. But that's still okay. I mean, in the future, they might find good uses for these things. And so how do they just sit around on a blank chalkboard and think really hard? Right, that's what I used to think as a kid. And it's actually a little like that. The mathematician profile says you have to read a lot, go to a lot of talks, talk to people, get your ideas out there, and then you find a problem that's unsolved currently, and you just keep thinking about it and wondering and trying to figure out a way that you can kind of probe the cracks in it. There might be some approach, and then just over time you're able to develop this, hopefully a breakthrough that will allow you mathematically to exploit it and get in there and figure out this mystery.
And, Bill, I talked to a mathematician, this is years ago, who said it's a challenge among theoretical mathematicians to come up with something so obscure that there's no practical application, and they keep failing, like a prime number theory. No way anybody can use this, and now it's the center of a lot of our online encryption. They, like, the things they discover that they think are useless keep having practical applications.
Yeah, and that's how it's been for history, for hundreds of years. Einstein was able to exploit this field of mathematician that dealt with three-dimensional tensors and weird rotation and extra dimensions that the mathematicians thought, no one will use this. This is just for us. This is our stuff. But Einstein's theories were weird and out there enough that he needed a new kind of math. And, oh, look, it had already been developed. It was there for him to use and explain physics.
We'll leave it there for now. Bill, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
That's Bill Andrews, Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. He joined us with a look at the latest news in space, math, and the world of science. And spoiler alert, Bill's going to be back with us in a week or so, along with one of his colleagues, to take a look at some of the biggest science news of 2018.